This program deals with themes of an adult nature and is intended for a mature audience.
The very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings.
Our differences worldwide would vanish if we were facing an alien threat from outside this world.
We must guard against the military-industrial complex.
UFOs, paranormal phenomena, and deep analysis of current world events from somewhere in the desert between Area 51 and Roswell, blasting across the planet, the Manticore Network proudly presents Fairy Tales, because the truth will set you free.
Headline edition, July 8, 1947. The Army Air Forces has announced that a flying disc has been found and is now in the possession of the Army.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
The power they took from the people will return to the people.
The Matrix is everywhere. It is all around us. It is the world that has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth.
Shall I tell you what I find beautiful about you? You are at your very best when things are worse.
Sooner or later, though, you always have to wake up.
Be skeptical, but don't close your mind.
Greetings to everyone around the world, and a warm welcome to another edition of Veritas at VeritasRadio.com. I'm your host, Mel Famergus, and I sincerely thank you for joining me once again. And if this is your first time, please make yourself at home. I want to thank you, Veritas member, for making Veritas possible. Please subscribe at VeritasRadio.com to listen to both segments of tonight's interview and all of our material. You'll receive your login immediately. And don't forget to purchase MMS right from us. It's better to have it and not need it than need it and not have it. And it's so inexpensive. You'd be glad you did. And Season 4 of our futuristic metal-cased USB drive is now available, along with all other seasons. Again, just go to the Veritas store. And to get in touch with us for member support, media inquiries, you want to be a guest, or are a whistleblower, there's a link for you by clicking on the contact button of our website at veritasradio.com. Tonight's special guest is another luminary I met at the gathering I recently attended in Philadelphia. Many of you know who she is. I'm referring to nuclear physicist, engineer, an author, Dr. Elizabeth Rauscher. Let's see where our conversation will take us. Dr. Elizabeth Rauscher has a doctorate degree in nuclear physics and engineering from the University of California at Berkeley. Dr. Rauscher was a nuclear scientist and researcher at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory and at Stanford Research Institute, SRI. Was a professor of physics at John F. Kennedy University of California and a research consultant to NASA for the Space Shuttle Program and the U.S. Navy. In the 1970s, Dr. Rauscher had a Q security clearance when she worked with physicist Edward Teller, father of the hydrogen bomb. She never wanted to work on weapons, and the work with Teller involved the cosmos. She turned down offers to work on Star Wars, and today she works on medical devices using electromagnetic radiation, EMR, to enhance health. Dr. Rauscher has been a delegate to the United Nations and a research consultant to NASA, a staff researcher at Stanford Research Institute, SRI International, and held a Stanford University grant. She has conducted extensive consulting research and invited to lecture in the USA, England, Europe, Japan, Korea, India, Africa, South America, Canada, Mexico, and Bermuda. And she has published over 275 papers and 6 books. and directly from Apache Junction, Arizona, not too far away from my location. For the first time on Veritas, I am honored to welcome Dr. Elizabeth Rauscher. Hello, Dr. Rauscher, and welcome to Veritas. How are you?
Fine. Excellent. Thank you very much.
What a privilege to have you on. And just to let the audience know, in the past couple of weeks, we've introduced some new luminaries, if you will, to our worldwide audience. I was at a Philadelphia gathering a few weeks ago, and I had the pleasure of meeting Dr. Rauscher in person, although I've heard about her before. And I have to tell you this, I read this from one of the people, Dr. Rauscher, that attended one of your sessions a few years ago. She said, quote, "I met and attended sessions at an international remote viewing conference in Las Vegas with Dr. Rauscher. I was, and I'm still in awe of feeling like I was in the presence of the smartest woman on the planet, a female Albert Einstein, if you will." What do you think about that, Dr. Rauscher?
I feel very complimented. And actually, I had two idols in high school. One was Albert Einstein, and I had a crush on Paul Newman. But it was Albert Einstein that I think I was much more influenced by.
Well, let me ask you. Your bio, as I was telling you offline, it's pages and pages long. I just summarized as much as I could. But it reads like an encyclopedia. I'm interested in knowing, from childhood, how does somebody like you develop the interest in so many of the areas that you have researched?
Well, I remember when I was about 4 years old, and as they say, a kid's outdoors watching the grass grow, and I thought, I'm not satisfied with my life because my parents and I didn't see eye to eye on many issues. Let's put it that way. And I decided that I would try to figure out what the nature of reality was. And then I remember watching my mom. My mom and dad were very authoritarian, and they were right. And if I even agreed with them, I was still wrong. And I watched her iron, and I was looking up, you know, I was short enough that I was still, I looked up at her, and I thought, do you automatically learn stuff, or do you have to study really hard? And then I thought, well, I better study really hard just in case. And then I had another influence. My mom probably couldn't get a babysitter, and I went with her and my dad to this very wealthy person's house that had all these international knickknacks from all their trips, and they talked about really interesting things. And a woman, I was about seven, and a woman handed me a book with a blue cover called Man's Right to Knowledge. And that was very influential. I thought, that's right. You know, I saw the picture of a lifestyle that had a little fake stream in the backyard and everything. And I thought, that's a lifestyle with all the books around. And my folks had a lot of books and magazines around it. That's what I aspire to. And that somehow maybe I'll understand absolute truth or some relative truth or some form of truth. So I heard about time machines. There was, when I was about eight, I was listening to Radio Mystery Theater, and there was this guy that wanted to invent a time machine because he almost ran over Hitler when the story almost ran over Hitler when Hitler was about 5 years old. So he wanted to go back in time and run over Hitler and prevent all that horrible disaster. So that intrigued me, the idea of going back in time and changing history. And then I met my sister's first husband was a math grad student at Berkeley, math and physics. So he handed me a book by Dover on Einstein, Minkowski, Lorentz, and the whole basis of relativity. So although I couldn't read differential equations, I could read the words and the content. So I really studied relativity to see whether you could make a backwards time machine. And I'm still working on concepts about that and having fun about it.
Do you think it's possible to time travel?
I think there's mental time travel. There's precognition to the future, and there's probably retrocognition, where these people have been looking for archaeological sites and trying to use remote viewers to do that. I do think also, like, why would I want to be an inventor? Because when I heard about Tesla from my brother-in-law, my sister's first husband, I thought, well, I want to be an inventor, and I also wanted to invent energy systems because I knew there would be wars over oil in the Middle East. Oil was a finite resource, and that's one of the reasons I studied nuclear physics, although I don't think that's the answer. Reactors are not the answer because of the waste problem and accidents and so forth. Although more people are killed in coal mines, it's still a problem. So I thought we need some kind of renewable energy source. And so I've been on that track and started the International Tesla Society. And when I decided to invent things, I started collecting stuff. Because I said, you got to have stuff to invent with. So I got old radio tubes, and I aspired to try to build an oscilloscope. I built 6 telescopes from 9 to 13. Some I took apart and built other better ones. And
at the age of 9?
Yeah. My folks were very social, so they go out in the evening and leave me alone to do my research.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know how I figured out how to... I knew how to take a light filament to figure out the focal length of the lenses. And my mom was getting camera equipment from Edmund Scientific, so I'd tape on a bunch of quarters and get a whole bunch of assorted lenses from Edmund Scientific. And I wrote a note with the taped on quarters for the lenses and said, you know, like I was a big research institute, except my handwriting was that of a child. They must have had a laugh. But then I found a nice long focal length lens for my objective, and I still have that one telescope.
What moved you to build the telescopes, almost like Galileo?
Well, several things. One is I met an astronomer when I was 8, and the guy was talking about, like, Carl Sagan, all the billions and billions of this, that, and the other thing. And I lived in a country where you really could see the stars in the Milky Way galaxy. And it was just beautiful. I mean, I was very intrigued. And also, I was nearsighted, and I had told my folks I couldn't see that. I had trouble reading because I was dyslexic and nearsighted. And when they held the book out, I couldn't see it. So part of it might have been because I was nearsighted. But mostly it was my interest in the universe. And I thought at 15 that one should take responsibility for everything in the universe on their shoulders to make the universe and the world and everything a better place. And I'm young now, I'm sort of childlike, but at 15 I was very old.
I understand.
And I felt old.
Your level of maturity back then, and as you say, Carl Sagan and the others were talking about the billions of stars, which if you use math, that's trillions probably of planets. Why do we keep saying that we are alone? Isn't that the height of arrogance?
I think it's absolutely the height of arrogance. I grew up in the country, and I've talked to many plants and animals, and they've talked to me. I feel I grew up on Witten Indian land, and I feel more like the philosophy of indigenous people, that everything is alive and conscious and has its rights and identity. And to try to dominate nature, which is the Western European and American way, is wrong because you're going to destroy yourself. You have to live in harmony with nature. I mean, that's the height of arrogance. And to say that we're alone in the universe was to give status to really the church and the power structures of the Middle Ages. And also, it's really lonely to be alone, so I think it'd be better to... But I don't know, you know, if the ETs come... my son and I were camping out where I used to live in the country, and so we were looking at the satellites going overhead, and he was about 14, and he said, we started talking about UFOs, and I noticed he pushed his sleeping bag closer to me. And I said, well, look, am I going to beat him up if they attack? He said, no, you might be able to talk to him better than me.
You know, you said something important about the church and maybe even science. I will explore that in a minute.
Oh, it's got its religious aspects, too. It's got its priesthood and, you know, the whole thing is these institutions, particularly academia, and the church, you know, you go through all these levels, and the military, too. I mean, it's very stratified, and it's very simsalabim to the leaders.
But it seems, Dr. Rauscher, that we have two areas. We have religion for what science cannot answer, and for what we can answer, then we have science. And it's almost as when people want to stop to shop for questions, almost as a religion. Is this the right way to look at science, almost like a religion?
Has a methodology, and if it's applied correctly, it should be objective. Like, there's several discoveries I made in my life that changed my personal philosophy, and one was psychic phenomena. Although I had some unusual experiences as a child, I objectively, scientifically did not believe in it until I did a whole bunch of experiments. But a true scientist changes their philosophy, you might say, to religion, to match the data. The data is more important. The facts are more important than what you believe them to be. That's a non-religion. That is using information to decide what's meaningful and real as opposed to what isn't. Whereas a religion says you believe or else. And that's what our educational system says. Shut up and believe the teacher. It doesn't allow for individuals to think and be their own human beings. And that's the key, is the freedom to think, the freedom to search for truth and knowledge and meaning within their own lives. And that's sort of the whole structure of the society, including religion, and also science. Although it has a methodology, sometimes I've seen situations that were unconscionable, like a very good physicist I know from England, and, you know, there's this Los Alamos X-Files, so it's sort of like the in-group and the out-group. You can publish in the X-Files if you're one of the buddy cats. Well, for some reason, somebody got ticked off. This guy had been publishing papers in the X-Files for years, and all of a sudden, they exclude him from the club and reject all his papers because somebody got ticked about him. Now, that's a religion.
And you said something important about the Native Americans and the fact that they were in touch with the planet, which to me, in the last 100 years, we've done more to destroy the planet than for the last thousands of years. But one thing that comes to mind is the word civilization. Many people think that that's a positive word, but the subversion of truth is the foundation of our quote-unquote civilization. Almost like truth these days, Dr. Rauscher, has become the new hate speech. And this happens in academia. This happens.
Yes. I mean, if you go out on a sunny day and point up in the air and say the sky's blue, somebody's bound to try to shoot you. I mean, I'm surprised. I mean, I've given talks where people were yelling and screaming at me, and I've had my life threatened based on what I said. And I thought, my God, I mean, there's a lot of things I don't believe, but I don't go around telling those people not to talk about what they think. I'm surprised at the power of the word. I'm surprised at the fear. I'm surprised at the control mechanisms. It astounds me. And civilization is a very thin facade. I mean, if the power goes out. Of course, we're on three wells in Apache Junction, which is outside of Phoenix. We wouldn't have any water because it wouldn't be pumped by electrical, mechanical pumps.
Right.
You couldn't get any fuel for your car because it's pumped out electrically. You couldn't get to the grocery store to get groceries. Your refrigerator wouldn't refrigerate anymore. And so there's these doomsdayers that are sitting around with all their guns. Now, that probably wouldn't be practical either, because you have to be awake 24 hours a day to keep off the hordes. But it'd be very interesting. There's a lot of interesting sci-fis about, viral attacks and end of civilizations. But it's a facade that keeps things together. It's not, it needs to come from deep within the person. And I would say it's scientific to be compassionate. In other words, compassion, to be kind to each other, to be kind to nature, to be kind to everything, I think is very, very crucial to the way to live.
But I think the issue these days has become more truth-driven. That's what I do. But what they do is profit-driven. It's okay to make a profit, to make a living, as long as you don't jeopardize the rest of the people and the nature around you. You mentioned it as a facade. How do we remove the facade?
Probably if we didn't have any power, that would remove it. But that's probably not the positive way. I'll give the other side of it. I meet all these young people. I mean, even, people in their teens. And I spent a lot of years learning a lot of things. And it's like they don't know the technical aspects I know, but they seem to know the life, living, compassionate aspect already. It's like they've already learned. There's a new generation that is growing up that seems to be much more in touch with nature. They may not want to learn technical things as much, and I don't know what it's going to do to the future of science. But in fact, they are much more civilized, is what I'd have to say, in the true sense of what I mean by that. To be civil, to be live in harmony. And they seem to have, there was sort of a movement in the 60s towards more natural living and living with nature and the environmental movement. That some of that got lost in the whole thing, but I think it's resurfacing again. And it's clear that if you're an astronaut doing a spacewalk and you cut off your lifeline, you're going to die. And that's what man's doing with nature, is cutting off his life support system. And it's out of extreme power and greed that I can't imagine.
What do you think has caused this new generation, and I've seen it, of these children, teenagers that seem more compassionate? What do you think has happened? Is it their DNA? What has caused this?
I'm not sure. It's like I actually planned to cause a revolution, and thinking once I decided established way of thinking needed some radical changes. And I don't know why they know it already, unless it's some kind of a psychic thing. But I see a whole thing that was trying to surface in the 60s, which didn't quite make it, because it got drowned in drugs and selfishness.
Mm.
But now I see these people, and I can't really explain it. It's just, it touches me deeply.
And somebody like you, and you and I were at this event a few weeks ago, I think of you, I think of Dr. Claude Swanson and many of the other luminaries that were there, that although you come from academia, you also discuss the paranormal. How do you reconcile both?
Have no problem with that. In fact, I just wrote a book with World Scientific called Orbiting the Moons of Pluto, Solving Maxwell Schrodinger Dirac Equation in Complex Geometries. It came out in 2011. And what it shows is the non-locality of consciousness, or consciousness being the basic reality, isn't inconsistent with the main body of physics and may explain some of the physics of non-locality. So I show a formalism that accommodates the nature of consciousness and may even require it for our understanding of quantum theory.
Now, if you could summarize the book.
The book said, actually, it's a whole bunch of papers I wrote over the last 40 years that got summarized as the book. Now they call it quantum entanglement. which is leading to quantum computers. And before you called, I was just reading a patent by Microsoft on quantum computing. And what it says is that if you have two parts of the universe, maybe two particles, that are correlated in their spins and momentum and direction at a particular space-time point, that as they move apart, they remain connected, and that everything is connected to everything like a web of reality. And once you affect one part of the universe, you affect the whole universe. And this is an expansion of the quantum effect. What I showed is there's a macroscopic non-locality if you consider a hyperdimensional geometry of 8 and 12 dimensions. And that allows and accommodates one to have a precognitive event without having the paradox of, say, going back in time and killing your grandmother before you're born. So it's like a time machine that can go forward and backwards in time, not so much to have an interaction at a space-time point in the past or future, but to access information.
Now, that's an interesting thought that I've always had, the creating the paradox. If theoretically, if time travel was a reality, and I went back, or you and I went back and killed our grandmother or grandfather, what would happen to us at the time?
Well, even if you think about it, I used to think of it this way, because I got rid of, fear and guilt do run a great deal of people's behavior, whether it's unconscious or not. And I thought about guilt, because I felt guilty being born to my parents because they were obviously dissatisfied. Then I thought, well, if they just had done the deed together a day earlier or a day later or even a nanosecond or a different sperm, I'd be a different person. I wouldn't be me. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting how the egg and sperm create that specific individual that is unique from every other individual and yet connected to the whole. And so when I realized that my parents had made the choice of when to go to bed with each other, then I relieved me of the guilt because I said it was their fault. I shifted the blame.
Right, right. And speaking of patents, I did a little bit of a research here in conducting my investigation, and I found a few patents that you have, and I was pleasantly surprised to see all the things that you have created in the business that you currently have. But let's take this one, for example. You have a patent that does enhancement of biological functioning by the use of electromagnetic and magnetic fields. Can you explain?
Yes, the first revolution in my thinking that really shifted my thinking was to realize that psychic phenomena was true. I had always thought thoughts were real. And then later when I got interested in whether you could have a non-invasive medicine or less invasive, and actually, there's a forcing function because of the expense of current medicine. To have a gentler medicine, it wouldn't replace setting a broken leg, but it would replace drugs for pain reduction and enhance wound healing. And the Soviets were much more interested in this area than the United States. And we'll talk about Project Paperclip. But to talk about this material, when I met my late husband, William Van Bice, in 1979, the first thing we talked about was the interpretation of Nikola Tesla's Colorado Springs experiment and his Wardenclyffe Tower and the relationship between those experiments. And the second thing was whether there were effects by low-intensity, low-frequency electromagnetic fields on biological tissues. Now, physicists generally go to the blackboard and prove that it can't be possible. However, all physics knowledge is limited. And besides, the proof is in the experiment, not in the theory. And he showed me that, man, are there powerful effects. and some can be really bad, but there are some that will enhance biological functioning. So I've worked over 35 years trying to bring forward a new medicine, and there's been others in the context of working with this, like Claude Swanson and others, and Robert Becker, William Ross 80, and that have found these profound effects that are, it's harder to find the positive effects, but you have to search carefully. And it's important because I felt there would be a revolution in medicine, which I think we're on the threshold of, because of the problems with the economics of medicine. And it's for people to take personal responsibility for their health. And the next thing is to take responsibility for their being. But it, health is a major symbol of personal responsibility. And within that context, to sort out the good non-invasive medicine from the sham or placebo effects that, say, some of the techniques appear to happen. I'll make a comment about homeopathy. I've researched it, and I haven't found any validity in it. Now, maybe I didn't do the research properly, but people seem to be getting benefits. But it's all going to sort itself out in trying to find out what the good complementary medicines are.
You mentioned Tesla and his experiment in Colorado. A lot of people are maybe not familiar with that experiment. Can you share with us that experiment?
Well, Tesla really, our electromagnetic age really depends on Tesla and his alternating current motor development. And he saw it in a vision in his head when he was in Yugoslavia. He came to the United States in 1884, and so I started the International Tesla Society in 83 to celebrate his 100th anniversary of coming to this country. He actually realized that to transmit power over long distances, you need to use AC. And, of course, there was the Edison development of the light bulb, which made it possible to have light at the other end of the power coming out of the circuit. And so there was the AC-DC wars that Edison wanted to use DC, and actually he kind of cheated Tesla. Tesla did a job for him for about $25,000 or $30,000, and Edison didn't pay him. The two were offered to share the Nobel Prize, and they turned it down because they wouldn't share it with each other. But with AC power, the whole generators of electricity were developed with his contract with Westinghouse. Well, in Colorado Springs, he was trying to harness and cohere the breakdown that occurs with lightning strikes over the mountains in the region where he had his laboratory, Pikes Peak. And so he was studying the discharge phenomena to see whether he could harness that as a method of collecting Earth ionospheric resonant phenomena to transmit power without wires. And that was the building of the system at Wardenclyffe in New York. So his correspondence between the various engineers working on his Colorado experiment and his Wardenclyffe tower getting built were clues as to how he thought he could harness this energy that lightning discharges the power is shown by the existence of lightning discharging in this Earth ionosphere resonant capacitive reactants, which he patented in 1905. And that's still possible, I think. Whether it can replace the power lines, some of the frequencies that are studied are natural harmonics of the Earth and Earth ionosphere resonance, but if would they affect bird flights and other things, I don't know.
And what happened afterwards? I believe there was some kind of an accident and he was actually asked to leave Colorado?
Well, what he would do is use the local generators to build up the power for his primary and secondary Tesla coils to try to build up a discharge that would form into a coherent, like a ball lightning or soliton state. And so he'd burn out the local generators, which he himself and his company built, and it'd piss off the local people that had just gotten electricity. And they got mad, and then sometimes sparks would come out of the middle of the street as he was doing his experiments, so they wanted to kick him out of town. And it was his stuff that they were pissed that they couldn't have anymore.
That's right.
Greedheads. Silly.
Is it true that J.P. Morgan approached him, and that the reason why we don't see this kind of technology is because, and we see wires, visual pollution, and you know, I'm lucky in my town that the power lines are underground and you don't see them. But is it true that J.P. Morgan said, wait a second, we can't meter this, so we cannot make it happen? So,
well, see, J.P. Morgan was funding Tesla.
Yeah.
In fact, he was what Tesla apparently had said to Morgan is that he was going to transmit information like radio transmission to Europe. And Marconi had spent 6 months in Tesla's lab and stole his idea. Actually, radio communication had been shown in the Chicago Fair of, I believe it was 1886, with remote control to a submarine-like vehicle that was a little model that Tesla had. So he'd already developed the radio wave and radio transmission and reception. But Marconi stole it. In 1947, Congress gave credit to Tesla the year he died for the invention of the radio, but people don't know that. They don't give credit to Tesla. And there's a case of science trying to write a guy out of the history books. So that was my purpose in the Tesla Society, to bring recognition to Tesla's work and bring him back into the history, which has been partially accomplished. Anyway, Morgan was funding the Wardcliffe Tower construction, and then at a certain point, when actually Tesla explained it was not only going to be information transmission like a radio, but energy transmission, then Morgan said, how are we going to meter this? And Tesla said, it won't be metered. And that's when Morgan withdrew his funding. Also, he had gotten cancer and was sick at the time, too. So he withdrew his funding, and that's why Wardenclyffe never got completed.
Now, Tesla deserves a full show. I've spoken with David Sarita, you now that have taken the torch and are still showing how important his work was. What happened later in life with Tesla? Just to take a couple of minutes, that he was sent to live in a hotel in New York without even allowed to leave the hotel room.
No, that wasn't true. He, of course, what happened was he had a contract with Westinghouse to meter, I forgot, it was 1/4 cents per so many watts. Well, the way the contract written, Westinghouse would soon go broke. So instead of renegotiating that contract with Westinghouse, Tesla tore it up, which meant that Westinghouse didn't have to pay it anymore. So then what happened was Tesla basically was broke or poor. And he lived in several hotels. The last one he lived in, I actually went to his room, the room where he died, in the New Yorker Hotel, which was partially open at the time. And this was in the late 1980s. And he could leave if he wanted to. He just didn't want to. He was became a recluse. He was very depressed, and he would keep writing Morgan letters and his relative letters to try to instigate the funding for Wardenclyffe. And of course, in World War One, they didn't want the German siding on anything on the coast, So it was before 1914 the Wardenclyffe Tower structure was destroyed. So he kept thinking he would get funding for his microwave and radar weapon systems. And he had a gold phone on the wall in his room. So he actually, I think the New Yorker just allowed him to live there for free. But he used to live in a lot of hotels and hang out with Mark Twain, Samuel Clemens. And they'd go out to dinner, get all dressed up, drink a bunch of wine, laugh, and have a good time. And then Tesla would take Mark Twain back to his lab. This was before he lived alone in the New Yorker. And then Tesla would say, well, you want to try out that bed, and it would vibrate at about 7.6 hertz. And a subharmonic that relaxed the anal sphincter. So he said to the, Mark Twain, don't stay on it too long, but he did. But anyway, those guys used to have fun. They would put lightning bolts out and bother the old ladies across the street in New York. But, yeah, I think he chose to live alone and feed pigeons.
Yeah, he lived there for 10 years, from 1933 to 1943, room 3327. But you mentioned 7.6 hertz that they were playing with. I don't want to repeat it, but you also use it in your patent.
I think he used 3.8. He may have used a subharmonic of 3.8.
Okay.
The 7.6 is the resonant frequency of the Purkinje process in the endocardium of the heart and the hindbrain or the cerebellum of the brain. And it's one of the antenna communication systems between the environment and the human and within the human itself, and also animals, mammals. And this is a very important frequency. It's also the frequency of the iliac bifurcation, where the main blood supply goes from the abdominal region down into the legs, is a standing wave of 7.6, which is part of the hemodynamics of the blood. So you have neuronal process, piezoelectricity of the bone. When you flex the bone, you actually produce a current flow. And then the hemodynamics of the blood, and their base frequency is 7.6. And it is similar to the Schumann resonance. We've measured that, and it usually varies from about 7.4 to about 7.8. But it is one of the natural frequencies we grew up in. And there's another frequency that we identified that apparently Tesla has in one of his patents, and that's a 30.4 hertz frequency, which is the bandwidth of frequency components from the cardiac and the brain systems that I think are very fundamental to operating the hypothalamic pituitary axis in the cerebrum. And I could explain that in more detail, but it'd take a while.
You mentioned the Schumann resonance and the 7.6 Schumann resonance being 7.83 cycles, and it's been changing since 1980. And before that...
No, when you measure it carefully, the natural frequency actually varies between about 7.4 and a 7.8. It naturally varies. It isn't absolutely set at 7.6. And 7.83, which is what some of people specify, is not correct. It's just one of the harmonics of the system.
Fair enough. But what has caused it to go all the way to 12 now?
It isn't 12.
No?
No.
Some reports that I've seen said that by 1987 it changed, and then by the dawn of the new millennium it rose to around 9 hertz, and now it's close to 12.
No, there are other frequencies. See, I have a patented detector with my late husband. Mm-hmm. There are other frequencies that are resonant within the ionospheric cavity. It isn't just the Schumann resonance. There's ones around 3 to 4 hertz, which relate to volcanic and seismic activity. There's the D, E, and F layer of the ionosphere. The D layer is 6.2 to 6.8. The E there is 12.4 to 12.8. And then the F1 and F2 layers are 14 to 23 hertz. So if you actually measured very well with a very sensitive magnetic field detector, you would find all those frequencies active at one time or another. So the Schumann resonance hasn't shifted.
So what we hear out there is not true then?
There's a lot of, here's the way I put it, there's accepted truth. There's accepted non-truth, there's non-accepted truth, and there's non-accepted nonsense. And there's a lot of non-accepted nonsense, unfortunately, and there's also a lot of accepted nonsense.
I'm glad you're clarifying, but since we're talking about sound frequencies, and then we'll talk about Operation Paperclip, but I want to just talk about something important. And you may have heard that during World War II, Goebbels, Hitler's propaganda minister, he wanted to change the tuning frequency for the philharmonics from 440 hertz to A432. Have you heard about that?
Yeah, I have. Actually, I do know about Project Paperclip. That's how we got Wernher von Braun, when they divided East to West Germany between the Soviet Union and the U.S. The U.S. got the space cadet types, and the Soviet Union got the Nazis that had been researching electromagnetic and acoustic, as well as acoustic waves on people, on mainly on humans. And unfortunately, prisoners and Jews that were being killed horribly.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Soviets always were more interested in electromagnetic effects on biological systems. And there were a few researchers in this country, like Saxon Burr, Ross Ady, Robert Becker, and others in that group, and us, and very few people, because it was squelched. I mean, it was just denied. But you can kill them or cure them. That's what I know. And so this was suppressed because some of the frequencies used by current technology are not good for people. They could be made to be good for people, but they're not. But I got in an awful lot of trouble, and I got threatened on the Capitol stairs to not talk about our research. And they even tried to pass a congressional law so we couldn't make measurements. And it's very interesting because we were measuring from about 1 to 100 hertz in the primary to look at nature's phenomena. And they were going to pass a congressional law, which we heard of through a friend of ours at the Library of Congress, to not be able to measure between 0 and 100 hertz. And a guy called up in the middle of the night, and I said, then they can't pass the law because doctors can't measure EKG or EEG. And they didn't pass the law. But this was in the 1880s.
In the 1880s or 1980s?
1980s. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay.
1980s. Off by 100 years. But anyway, and some things I'm just not going to speak about publicly because I'm tired of having hassles.
I understand.
What I wanted to do is I figured the way to do it is to introduce the positive effects and benefit people, and maybe when they're in less pain and better health, they'll act nicer.
Well, isn't this, it's a matter of balance. If we have too much salt in our bodies, it's bad. We can die. But if we don't have enough salt, we can also die.
Right. And that's the point. What happens when a system gets ill is it gets out of balance. And part of it is the ATP metabolism, that the person isn't sufficiently able to run, we might call the human engine. And so what part of it is to sort of recharge the life battery, as I see it, so that the natural healing forces can take over. But you can specifically tune certain frequencies to enhance neuronal activity, produce endorphins and enkephalins and serotonin and dopamine, and not just produced them, but balanced them to the normal states that a biological system needs. What's interesting about healing is the body has an innate knowledge of what health is and the movement towards health. Then environmental and other factors, of course, affect the biological system and can get it out of balance. But by introducing the proper frequencies at proper intensities, waveforms, and so forth, one can retrain the body to those normal conditions, and then you don't need to subject them to the frequencies anymore because they entrain after a while and become healthy again.
I've received a few emails from people who have used frequencies to cure. And this reminds me of Royal Raymond Rife. You obviously have heard about Rife.
Yes.
Do you think that this is the reason why they don't want you to publish this information? Because this could jeopardize...
Well, mainly that we found certain frequencies that cause harm. I don't want to...
Right.
I don't want to publish those either. But I think it was also an era. As the Chinese proverb goes, he who watched body of enemy float by has succeeded. And a lot of the people that were opposing our work and others doing work in our area, including blackballing Robert Becker, who was nominated for the Nobel Prize, they've died of old age. And so I think that we're in a new era. I feel positive about it. I do know about Rife's work, but there's several different modalities. Some were developed at the turn of the last century, and that was to produce a broad band of frequencies. You do need to know, you don't want to just have a sine wave. You need a complex waveform because the body's complex. But there are ultraviolet ray machines and other things that were based on actually a Tesla spark gap generator that were used for healing devices. And some of it was just novel stimulus. But I think in Rife's case, I've studied the frequencies, but they're not necessarily the ones that I found. But I don't know the basis on which he calibrated his frequencies because that's changed over the years.
My late father-in-law passed away in 1999, and he died of a very rare form of cancer. And he actually purchased a Rife machine. And I asked the family, you know, did he use it? And the problem was he could never find an instruction book. And I think this is what happens. You see a lot of machines out there, but somebody has made an effort to remove the instructions on how to use them. Do you think this is on purpose?
Well, you know, people have blackballed people throughout history. I mean, that's just, I think that it takes a certain amount of, let's go back to this. When I first decided the psychic phenomena was real, people were reading my mind accurately, and I wasn't reporting to anybody, so they couldn't record it.
Mm-hmm.
When I decided how real it was, then I thought, well, I can't go to the head of LBL and say, man, it turns out this stuff is real, because, man, would I be out of there. They kicked my ass out so fast, and the rest of me, too. So I spent about 3 sleepless days deciding that the truth is the truth, and that's the one you go with. And maybe sometimes you keep your mouth shut, but I didn't. I got in trouble. I call it the foxhole effect. If you stand up and say something and the society doesn't want to change with you, you can get in trouble. So part of this is resistance to change, and then money and power invested in the system the way it is. And those guys don't want the change. I mean, pharmaceutica probably wouldn't want any kind of a gentler medicine. And some sort. I had a doctor friend of mine go to a cardiac clinic in Stanford, and he asked about if you could have a non-invasive pacemaker. It was completely external, but would entrain and paste a heart. And you were researching it, what would you do? And they said they'd lie about it because they want the money for the surgery.
Mm.
And that was in the 1980s. And the thing is, it slowly changes, but I don't know. It's like, in a sense, some knowledge gets, or some inventions get embraced. I mean, we're really living in a totally different era with computers.
I recently spoke with a gentleman with the name of Barry Trower in England, and he was a former intelligence. And his job during the Cold War was to interrogate, capture Russian spies. And what he found was the actual electromagnetic and microwave frequencies that they were using. And he actually published the frequencies so that people become aware that, yes, frequencies can be used as a knife to cut an apple or to kill. Now, you probably obviously know the negative ones too. I think, if I'm not mistaken, you had done a lot of research and work with, and we'll come back to the sound frequencies because there's something else that I want to discuss with you, but you have dealt with mind control. Can you explain of the research you've conducted in mind control?
Well, mostly my research really was we had done a whole series of experiments to see whether we could enhance vision and make the blind see. And this seemed to be something that went on from the beginning when Bill and I got together. We later got married and co-patented, co-researched, hung out together. And I think we were pretty together. I sure missed him when he died. But he decided to do that, and I couldn't do anything about it. Maybe I can get Perry Mason, who I think has died, to sue Bill for dying. Now, that was an interesting conundrum. Well, back to frequencies. Yes, you can actually influence a person's mind if they do know they've been influenced by a frequency, because we did experiments on ourselves. And some of them were like marijuana frequencies, and you knew you were experiencing the frequency. And but I also was nauseated. We were supposed to go out to dinner at Denny's, and we're laughing because we sort of were like high, but from a set of frequencies. And I didn't know what they were because Bill had turned them on, and I didn't know what he had used. I used to be a victim. But I found out later and reproduced the experiment. But what was interesting is we got people that had sort of a contact high. And even when I decided not to be nauseated, I couldn't overcome the effect. It went away eventually. And I've seen other people where they were bouncing off the walls denying they were influenced. So you can do that. But you can also inject images into people's brains, specific geometrical forms, which we saw as a basis of trying to help the blind see. So that was the motive for the experiments, and I think we could do that, but it would take about $10 million of research funding, which I don't have. But yes, you can influence people's minds, and they may be already influenced by all the stuff in the environment, both chemical, electromagnetic, and everything else, and thought forms.
I want to be positive. I want to always think that our government can be trusted. However, they have disappointed me again and again. We have digital TVs now, Dr. Rauscher, as you probably know, and You're mentioning some of the frequencies that can be used to control the population. Do you think that digital signals, digital TVs, can be used to manipulate the thoughts of the population?
Theoretically, yes. I'll give you this example. Then, before when we had analog TVs in the 70s, what was interesting is I remember when I was writing my PhD thesis in the 60s and 70s, I had to do graphs, so I spent 2 years. I had actually written a program, but it had gotten corrupted. And so I decided instead of rewriting the program, which took me 2 years, to just graph it by hand. So I watch old movies, and because I was looking down and I'd look up at the screen, both during the movies and during ads, sometimes there were subliminal messages, like the whole screen would be white with black lettering. And I couldn't read the whole set of letters. I mean, it was a word of some sort, and I could read part of it. And I went to a conference at UC Berkeley on subliminal messages. And there were a number of people that had detected these. And there were some ads I just purposely wouldn't look at. I felt repelled by them. And as I say, some was in ads and some was in the movie itself. So that was going on. And so I don't know what you could do all kinds of things with digital too, but it was going on with the analog.
So if we could do it with analog and we can actually transfer more information via digital, imagine what can be done. But we have to take our one and only intermission so you can get some water and calibrate on your side. But when we come back, I want you to discuss an experiment that you and your late husband, Dr. William Van Buys, conducted on TV, on CNN.
Oh, yeah.
On CNN, yeah. with a reporter. You actually demonstrated and you actually implanted direct magnetic signals into the brain of the reporter that caused visual images as in a hallucination. So when we come back, and also I asked you a question, but I guess that we didn't have time to answer on this segment, the A432 Hertz and the A440 Hertz used now to find to tune the instruments. I want to get your take on that, but tell people how can they be more exposed to your work, your website, your books?
Okay, I actually haven't really worked on developing my website. It's ElizabethRauscher.net, and I just have my resume, and I haven't had time to get up some really good stuff. But I have books and papers that I'll eventually put on my website. If you Google me, there's a whole bunch of hits, and I think there's some stuff on me on Wikipedia. I haven't really organized myself on the internet yet. I'll just make a comment about computer addiction. Man, I tell you, those guys can take up your time. I mean, Jesus, but it's amazing. I mean, the information transmission between people. I mean, it's causing like the Arab Spring, fall, summer, and whatnot. It's amazing what it can be used for. Really good stuff.
And we have links on our website. Folks, don't go anywhere. The best is yet to come. I'm here with Dr. Elizabeth Rauscher. And we have so much more to discuss in segment two. This is Mel Fabregas, and you're listening to Veritas. We'll be right back. Thank you very much for listening to the first segment of this interview. We will continue with segment two with our special guest in the Veritas member section. Just go to our website, veritasradio.com, and click on the subscribe link. To listen to the rest. We'll take a short intermission, listen to some music, and we'll be right back with segment two in the members section. Enjoy.
This is John Peterson from the Arlington Institute, and you're listening to Veritas.